So I was at a lecture that Joseph Goldstein was giving, and this is in Los Angeles, and he gave a talk and led a guided practice and then opened it for questions. And a friend of mine was, it was a big crowd, but a friend of mine I saw from across the audience, he rose his hand and his question, what he said was, you know, 10 years ago I was at one of your lectures and I asked you to sum up the Dharma in one sentence, and you said, anything can happen anytime. And now here we are, all 10 years older, 10 years more practice, and I'll ask the same question, like, please summarize the Dharma in a sentence. And he said, the mind that's not clinging to anything. And so I wanted to look at this this question of letting go. What does it mean to let go? What do we let go? And when I think about like what a Dharma life is, what it means to abide in Dharma, what it means to integrate the practices, the silence into one's life, it constitutes a kind of life of letting go, a life of letting go. And this is a theme that we see through so many of the different teachings. And sometimes people associate letting go with kind of like renunciation, or it's like what's left in the wake of letting go. If we let go, what do we have? And this is something we have to actually see for ourselves, but what I want to suggest is that almost everything that is good is cultivated in the wake of letting go. That we need not be concerned about feeling bereft or like we're stranded in some kind of desolate place of nothing. Greed, and you know, if we had to categorize, like, okay, what are like the wellsprings of suffering? This, sometimes the Buddha broke it down very simply, and what the two of these like core forces, greed and aversion, greed and hatred, what I think we can actually see is that those forces of the mind require clinging. That there's no way to be acting out greed and aversion without clinging. And yet, love really asks only that we let go. Now, interestingly, in the foundational text on how to practice meditation that forms the basis of what we're doing, what's done typically at this center and lots of insight centers, is the Satipatthana Sutta. And there's this refrain that is repeated in that sutta. So in the Buddha describing like how to attend to the body, to feelings, to the mind. And the refrain is, you know, one attends to the body, not clinging to anything in this world. not clinging to anything in this world. This is like the description of how to actually be mindful. Now, it doesn't mean to like live a life that's dedicated to letting go. It doesn't mean that we stop organizing or planning or trying to arrange conditions to our favor and to the favor of others. But it means that, in a sense, we place our ultimate trust in letting go. That's where our faith is. That when we actually think in concrete ways, how will I be happy? We answer, I will let go. So what are we letting go of? In one sense, we're letting go of ownership. Letting go of ownership, like this kind of possessiveness that underlies so much struggle. This is Andy Olensky, a scholar. Why is it that humans tend to feel possessive and acquisitive about all aspects of experience? The ownership of property is embedded in most legal systems, but in drawing out the implications of the Buddhist insight, one sees that this is an extension of a much more profound habit of mind. It is this very sense of ownership that's directly responsible for both individual and collective suffering. Ownership is a node around which greed and hatred coagulate and is itself an expression of a profound delusion which gives rise to all sorts of strife. Ownership is a node around which greed and hatred coagulate and is an expression of a profound delusion. So what does it feel like you own? Right, it's a lot. It feels like we own our career and things, our reputation, our views. It feels like we own our country, whatever that means. It feels like we own our body. The Buddha recast all of this to say that you own nothing, and even what you call yourself, it's not that it doesn't exist, but you don't own it. And we can start to actually see how much pain arises out of the sense of ownership, owning our body, owning another person, owning our thoughts. Now, to let go of ownership does not mean to live an uncommitted life. It doesn't mean to live at a kind of aimless, undirected life, or a life of no commitment, right? Like just because it's a rental car doesn't mean you try to crash it. Sometimes, like, the unpossessibility, you know, of everything, it's kind of, can almost feel haunting. You know, it's like this abiding fantasy in me, just like to get and to have. And yet, we influence a lot, but own nothing. Now, one aspect of the heart is the heart like closes up when we actually sense the unpossessibility of all things. But it need not move in that direction. It can also breed a kind of very deep openness. It means that that everything's given to us. I heard this story from Michelle McDonald. She was, teaching in Burma, and she was visiting. She's an insight teacher, and she was visiting this very elderly teacher. I think he was in his late 90s, and in the kind of reverential title of Sayadaw. And she described this particular Sayadaw as being like just infectiously happy, and he'd been a monk for like many decades, and she could really like feel the fruit of that commitment. And at some point, I think she and some other teachers, senior students, were in a room with him talking, and they were talking about dana, this Pali word for, of kind of generosity. And usually that's talked about in the context of money and the way that teachers or centers are supported, dana, it's offered, that kind of thing. And so she was like asking some question about dana, how to approach that or what to think about that. And he got like really animated, and he said like, "You want to talk about dana?" And he goes over to a kind of altar, and there was like fruit, which is typical, like some fruit on the altar of the Buddha. He said, "You want to talk about dana?" And he like grabs all the fruit and he just throws it in Michelle's lap, right? Like, that's dana, right? And then he keeps going. He's like, "This roof, that's dana. Your body, dana." Given to us, here it is. Now, ordinarily, what we love, we feel like we should hold most tightly, right? Like that which is most loved is what we hold most dear, like. And it's a very natural kind of movement of the heart. But what happens, of course, is that the love of something becomes entangled with the clinging of it. And they're very different actual movements of the heart. The love is a kind of offering and a form of connection, and the clinging is a form of control. And they become like wound up in each other, and it's hard to tell them apart. But the clinging to what is loved compromises the lover and what is loved. And part of our practice is actually learning to distill out the clinging from the love. so that the love has the flavor of letting go rather than holding on. And so we can live a life of love and not cling. We can love pleasure without clinging to it. Right. We can actually develop a relationship with pleasure which is where there's less friction with it. That we're, in a sense, realistic about what pleasure can and can't do for our hearts. It's really just gets problematic when we sort of overestimate what pleasure buys us, what it can do for us. And often when we're like clinging to pleasure, there is a sense that the pleasure, the object of desire, is not merely pleasure, but it is a cessation of clinging, that it represents the end of clinging. When I look at pizza, I do not merely see pleasure. I see pretty much the solution to all my questions. It's like right there. Yeah? But pleasure is can only do so much. Yeah? We can love ourselves without clinging and defending ideas of ourselves. You know, in a sense, usually when we think about self-love, we think about like, I'm so good, you know, like I'm like so whatever, fill in the good adjective, right? But there's an inherent fragility in that. Yeah. And maybe the kind of deepest form of self-love is actually letting go with respect to who we think we are. So these are a couple researchers who are interested in mindfulness, among other things. The question becomes not merely how high or how low self-esteem is, but what one is doing when evaluating the self as an object. The very process of placing oneself in the role of object and then evaluating its worth is problematic. There are people who are preoccupied with their worth. They regularly appraise themselves, compare themselves to others, and struggle to ward off threats to a positive view of self. Whether such individuals come away with positive or negative conclusions, the very fact that one's esteem is in question suggests a psychological vulnerability. Optimal health is more likely when self-esteem is not a concern, because the worth of the self is not at issue. The Buddha said, the wise don't take a stand in thoughts of themselves. I love that phrase, like, don't take a stand in thoughts of themselves. Like, we're so often in that kind of debate of, like, the pros and cons of me. And it's almost like as soon as we begin to really engage in that debate, we've lost. And the alternative is actually stepping out of the kind of compulsive need to endow the self with certain attributes, to own something, to be someone, to make life always mean something about who we are. Bhikkhu Bodhi. Ordinarily, our benighted attempts to achieve security are oriented around the standpoint of self. We assume that we possess a solid core of individual being or inherently existent ego, and thus our varied plans and projects take shape as so many maneuvers to ward off threats to the self and promote its dominance in the overall scheme of things. The Buddha turns this whole point of view on its head by pointing out that anxiety is the twin of ego. He declares that all attempts to secure the interests of ego necessarily arise out of clinging, and that the very act of clinging paves the way for our downfall when the object to which we hold perishes, as it must by its very nature. The Buddha maintains that the way to true security lies precisely in the abolition of clinging. We can love others without clinging. Even if we don't consider ourselves like the possessive type controlling, there is some, usually some currents of a certain kind of possessing the other. And this is evident in maybe especially in intimate sexual partnerships, but I think is evident across a wide range of relationships. This is Stephen Mitchell on partnership. He's a psychologist and writer. Why the need for all this control? It points to just how unprotected and vulnerable we feel when in the throes of uncontrived desire. Dependency is not a holdover from childhood. It's constitutive of desire for another person. And the vulnerability of dependency makes us feel endangered. The vulnerability of dependency makes us feel endangered. Rilke said that the best relationship is one in which your love for the other exceeds your need for the other. The love actually exceeds the need. And this doesn't mean that we live an uncommitted kind of life, or that we're not willing to give our heart away. That there's incredible like strength in being willing to need another, a kind of courage in feeling safe amidst dependency, even though it's endangering. You know, so one kind of approach, like, to out of clinging is just like, I won't depend. I'm just not going to put my heart on the table. But that's its own form of bracing against life. And so there's a lot of beauty and power in being willing to need, but the love actually being exceeding the need. Kernberg, a psychoanalyst, said love is the realization of the other person's freedom. Love is the realization of the other person's freedom to actually be able to look at a partner, at a child, at a parent, at a loved one, and deeply honor the otherness of the other. Like, it's very easy in the throes of clinging to like find ways of fitting the other into our subjective position, that they sort of fit here, right? But we fit there too. Like that, like this whole radical world of interiority, of subjectivity that is inherently unpossessable. And so we start to of infuse a love with this spirit of letting go. We can love our life without clinging to it. No, maybe a couple years ago I was walking around the grocery store, and I was just noticing my mind was kind of relaxed and open, and I had like this like a toothache, and I'm kind of afraid of the dentist, and but I was just like just kind of taking in the kind of openness of the space, and just the thought arose, like, if I weren't afraid to die, life would be radically open. And I actually got a real kind of intuitive hit of like just how open life would feel. And even if we're a little less afraid, even if we cling a little less, the whole kind of expanse of freedom can open up to us. You know, the truth is that even 1,000 years would feel too short. Somebody coming at this a very different angle, a philosopher, Parfit, was kind of famous for thought experiments and interrogating this question about identity that I'll speak about, this is how he describes like the kind of visceral fruit of his you know, like sustained decades of philosophical investigation. Said in the past that my life seemed like a glass tunnel through which I was moving faster every year, and at the end of which there was darkness. When I changed my view, the walls of my glass tunnel disappeared. Now I live in the open air. This is actually pointing to, it's hard to say where my life begins and ends. With all of the impacts, all of the kind of mutuality, all of the ways that our life kind of ripples out, exactly where do we begin and end? And what does it mean to die? What does it mean when this dies? Now we can spend really our whole life clinging and not knowing an alternative. But the Dharma, this path of practice, is an alternative. And when we look, the Buddha emphasized sila samadhi panya, like the ethical conduct, kind of heartfelt non-harming, samadhi, the cultivation of the mind, gathering of the attention, and panya, wisdom. And we can see how each of these is maybe in a sense animated by letting go, by this theme. So it may be a little obscure, like how would it be that that our ethical conduct is a product of letting go? But my experience is that that just over the years of practice, there's something just in staying with it, in just staying. We're just here, staying with all that comes through, with like the full expanse of mind states that are a human life. We stay. And there's something about this that actually softens something in the heart. That it's like the human condition becomes more and more poignant. And through the process of letting go, we really are, we're letting go of the forces of suffering, of greed, hatred, delusion. And we can actually explore, like, what is left? What is left in the wake of letting go? Do we have to let go and then, like, create goodness? Or is what's there? And what I would say, like, what's left in the wake of letting go? Sometimes it might be love, but at the very least, it's a radical non-hate. That hatred actually is supported and propped up by clinging, and if we let go, that is extinguished. Letting go is very connected to this called second, like, core capacity of samadhi. In fact, the Buddha even says the meditator who makes letting go the primary object of meditation achieves samadhi. Usually, there's a lot of clinging in the process of, like, trying to engineer samadhi. Trying to engineer the quiet in the mind. But the development of, like, a gathered mind is largely a function of letting go. Letting go of the need to fix one's life. letting go of the kind of need to attend to all the kind of urgent bells that ring in the mind and body, but are, you know, in a sense, false alarms. We can just allow those alarms to ring, and we let them go. We let go of the need for progress and pleasure. We let go of the need to, like, engineer happiness in this moment. We let go of the need to be oriented, even. As we get more and more settled, there's a certain way in which we see that our thinking and perception is a way of keeping us situated, of reminding ourselves who we think we are, of staying safe. So I'm here and you're there. This is my body. That's my past. This will be my future. And we let go. We let go. We let go. And then lastly, this letting go cultivates wisdom, panya. This is the Majjhima Nikaya. This truth I have reached is deep, hard to see, difficult to awaken to, quiet and excellent, not confined by thought, subtle, sensed by the wise. But people love their place. They delight and revel in their place. It's hard for people who love, delight, and revel in their place to see this ground, this conditionality, conditioned arising. And also hard to see this ground, the stilling of inclinations, the relinquishing of bases, the fading away of reactivity, stopping, cessation. So what does this mean, this sense of people love their place, they delight and revel in their place? Lots of interpretations, but what we can actually explore is that in our experience, our attention is consistently getting caught on phenomena. And the image that I have is it's like a hangnail getting caught on fabric. And by caught, I mean like we fixate something, a sight, a sound, a thought, a feeling, into this like solid thing. You know, so the thought arises and like we kind of like cling to it or identified with it. And this actually creates a kind of sense of our place, our ground. The phenomena are not like arising and passing, they're actually, we're getting entranced by meaning, rather than actually sensing the flow of experience. And so this creates our sense of place, our sense of place. But there are other ways of actually being with phenomena, being with experience. Again, from one of the suttas, where there's passion. Just as if there were a roofed house or a roofed wall having windows on the north, the south, or the east. When the sun rises and a ray has entered by way of the window, where does it land? And the answer, on the western wall. And if there is no western wall, where does it land? On the ground. And if there is no ground, where does it land? On the water. And if there is no water, where does it land? It does not land. So what would that be like to be awake in such a way that light is not landing anywhere, that thoughts are not landing anywhere, that feelings are not landing anywhere? That nothing is getting stuck, that the mesh of our being is open wide enough, the attention is relaxed enough that our life is flowing through. Life is just flowing through. There's just impermanence at every sense gate. The light does not land on the western wall or on the roof or the floor. And that's a different way of being in the world that transforms our sense of what the world is. And so more and more our life, our body, our mind is a sense of it being pervaded by space. And there's no place for suffering to congeal when there's just space. And so that may sound like a kind of a certain dryness, emptiness, but the heart is still responsive. It's like it just takes one drop of love to like flavor space. And then the whole space is filled up with it. So, yeah, life of letting go. Let's just sit for a moment. Just a quick editorial note. Some of that probably didn't make sense. That's okay. Yeah. Just take whatever is nourishing and onward leading, and leave the rest behind.